do you have any thoughts about last session, or should we go from the post-Vance trip to just about the scheduling of this big trip, I guess, is this hiatus in...
We might talk briefly of the trip I made soon after that to the Northeast. I might say there was a little minor comic interlude after the session I had with the AP board, the reception at the residence. They then invited me to join their farewell banquet the next night. And Keith Puller told me that he had said to the group, "Don't you think we should have woodcock for dinner?" And one of their numbers said, "Oh, do the Chinese know how to fix that?" Thinking they were going to get a little bécasse flambé, I guess. But it was very shortly after that I made my first extended tour in China. Went to, by train to Shenyang, which is very interesting. Took the day train deliberately to see the countryside. Went through Tangshan, the earthquake, and saw from the train you could see a great deal of devastation, but of course we weren't allowed off the train to walk around, although we were pulled into the station for about 30 minutes. And it was daylight all the way except for the last 4 hours when it was dark. I'd say one of my hosts said, "Why did you take the train?" I said, "To see the countryside." He said, "Why? It's all the same." Now we got to Shenyang, and we were met, of course, as always, by China Travel Service, and driven what seemed like a very long way. And we pulled into what seemed to be a park with guards on the gate, not only with guns, but with bayonets. And we drive by and we see shadowy outlines of buildings with no lights in them. Finally, we pull in front of a large villa with lights blazing in the lobby area. And I had Rick Bach as my traveling companion because he spoke good Chinese. We were taken to our rooms. I had a suite, which Chinese standards was very elegant. Got up the next morning and walked around. This was an area somewhat similar to the Aoyutai in Peking. Many villas, all seemed to be empty. The building we were in, we were the only two at that point. A high wall running around three sides, and the lake on the fourth side. This huge establishment. We seemed to be literally the only guests in the place, the staff in some of the houses and guards. We had asked in advance in Shenyang I think it was Shenyang, where there's an aircraft factory, but of course they never said no. We just never got an answer. And went to see Shenyang Heavy Machinery Plant Number 1. I was struck by the surplus of labor and the equipment that was standing idle. My notes, I estimated 30-40%. But the floor was not only an earthen floor, but this was the worst flooring I saw in any Chinese plant. And we deeply pitied. I kept looking down because I wanted to know where to put my foot. The deputy manager who was taking us around said, it's very bad. We're going to fix it, he said, without my asking a question. And then in the, as I say, there was a great deal of surplus labor, not much labor discipline. Then in the afternoon, we went to a transformer plant. Now, this was a much smaller plant. And a very mechanical operation. And there, the people were working quite hard. And in every place, of course, in those days, we'd be told how, which was, I'm sure, true, they had designed much of their own machinery, which later on, of course, was really quite wasteful, because each enterprise making its own machines, making its own deviations, so that there was no interchangeability of parts, and although they were pretty good examples of ingenuity, that really, from a total industrial standpoint, was not an efficient way to do it. And then in the evening, we met with provincial and municipal officials of the Provincial Revolutionary Committee of Liaoning Province. And my colleague, Rick Bach, asked, how was the fifth member of the Gang of Four, meaning Mao's nephew?
Who? Mao Yanxian.
Rick, exactly. Who was still, of course, extant. And I certainly wouldn't have asked the question. We didn't get any answer. They just all shifted uncomfortably in their seats and looked at one another and changed the subject. Then we went down to Anshan.
Let me just stick with just a minute on a visit by an ambassador, at that point head of liaison office with rank of ambassador. Who received you, and how did you make arrangements for a trip like that?
We had to let protocol, the foreign ministry, know the place of the cities we wanted to go, and in general, what we wanted to see. We knew, had no idea before we left whether our wishes would be granted or not. When we got there, we were received, and our China Travel Service guide would sit down with us. Now, what is it you want to do? And would then respond, how about this, how about that, having an already predetermined.
Did you have a Ministry of Foreign Affairs person accompany you, or did you just go with Bach?
Just Bach and I went.
And then you were met at the train?
At the train, each separate place.
And by the Travel Service or the Foreign Affairs Department of the
Travel Service.
Uh-huh.
In the meetings with the Provincial Revolutionary Committee, there would be a Foreign Affairs Bureau person. But that would be somebody stationed with the provincial authorities. That was always true.
But they did not accompany you. It was China Travel Service.
Right.
As you know, when foreigners visit, frequently the Foreign Affairs Bureau assigns someone to travel.
Right.
With you. And do you pay for the trip like that, or do the Chinese absorb any of the costs?
No, we paid for the housing, and we paid for our meals, except when the meals were being hosted by the Chinese. We paid for the transportation, and of course paid for the travel, so that in effect pay for it. Now, the charge they made for this very elegant guest house in Shenyang was very, very nominal, very reasonable. Not what they developed in the period before I left.
Was this a place to the north of town? Do you remember where? Was it the old compound of the north of the Manchuria Railway Company?
It was very close to the across the lake was the tomb area.
Yes, that's it. That's where. Yeah. It was. That's right. And also near there was a big guest house, very tall guest house. Do you remember on the other side of the road?
That I don't remember. So the next day we left Shenyang to go down to the to Anshan to see that Anshan Iron and Steel complex and that technology was very backward. The thing that struck me most was the lack of safety precautions. Almost a bit frightening, very frankly.
I remember visiting Anshan in 1970, a winter of 1972-73, I guess it was 72, December 72. Also, the same impression, very...
And the housekeeping was terrible. The stuff all over the place, and just thrown, and scrap discarded. And that, by the way, was in contrast to the Capital Iron and Steel Works, which I saw subsequently in the environs of Peking. The technology not much different, but the housekeeping much better. And of course, this was a huge complex with 100,000 employees when you included the nearby iron mines, which is part and parcel of the same management.
It even now produces 25% of all China's steel.
Yes. And so we didn't stay overnight there, but on this whole trip, even then in the fall of 77, during the sushi period, the siesta time after the luncheon, when we'd have at least two and a half hours. We were free to roam anywhere we wanted without any interference. The same thing was true in the evenings when no special event was set up. Nobody bothered to accompany us. And, of course, at that time there was particular interest in wall posters, so that. Rick Bach and spent a lot of time prowling around looking for wall posters that might tell us a bit more about what was going on.
When you went off on this trip and others, what kind of a briefing did you receive beforehand? Did you read into what was known about the locality? Did you get cables from Washington about Liaoning, or did you just mainly count on what your assistant knew about it?
Well, you'd read Nagel's, of course, for the general cultural and other background of the particular locality. And the CIA had city briefings on all of these places. There weren't many around the liaison office who'd been to these places, so that there weren't too many places one went to at that time where someone could say, well, I've been there and this is what to expect and so on, because I had not been that much travel. As a matter of fact, the staff was very pleased of my willingness then to travel, because I always took someone with me, that gave them a chance to go to these places where otherwise at that particular time that have had some difficulty in going. Then we went from Shenyang, again by train, to Changchun. Again, we were in a guest house rather than a hotel, but this one was in the center of town. And not nearly as an elaborate a layout as in Shenyang. I had said before I left Peking to my colleagues I wanted to see a film studio in China. Oh, they told me they'll never let you see that. But when I got to Changchun, I repeated my request, of course. At that time, as far as I knew, there were only three film studios, the one in Changchun, the one in Shanghai, and one in Peking. And they greeted me very warmly. They were filming two young men from the 8th Route Army was the title of it. It was still in the same cultural pattern as prescribed by Changcheng. And so I sat through the filmings and the rest of it. All the cameras were motionless so that all the action was the individuals had to walk into the camera. No close-ups. Although D.W. Griffith had the close-up in 1914. You know, I had really expected, the reason I asked to see the film studio, I thought, here's one place with a genius for propaganda that I would see the very latest technology, or at least the very latest Soviet technology. And they did all the filming. And the audio was dubbed in separately. And they took me into the studio where they'd show what they had filmed up on the screen. And then the same actors who had done that would watch it and synchronize their talking with the mouth motions on the screen. And then separately again, they'd dub in the music. The background, and then before they also showed me scenes from some completed movies, and an educational movie, How to Feed a Baby. I must say that I was reassured to see that Chinese women did in fact have breasts, because the way they were dressed, you couldn't know otherwise. And then that evening had a meeting with the vice chairman of the Revolutionary Committee of Jilin Province. And these meetings were for the most part surprisingly alike. You'd get a lot of you'd always get the denunciation of the Gang of Four, but it was all a standard. Standard pattern.
Did foreign policy subjects come up?
No. If you try to steer the conversation in that direction, they would avoid it, debate it. But there was one. This was some 2 months later. When the vice mayor of Guilin suddenly volunteered his opinions of Jimmy Carter, which were not very high.
You sent back a cable on that, as
yes.
I recall.
Yes. It visibly upset his colleagues. Then toured the big truck factory in Changchun, which has a... then had an annual capacity of 60,000 units. The only traditional moving assembly line that I saw anywhere in China. had the technologies of the late 30s, although occasionally you'd see an up-to-date machine stuck in someplace. Went into the engine plant, the chassis plant, the final assembly, which is where the moving line was. And of course, always saw the ancillary facilities, particularly the kindergartens, which were always delightful, but I must say that I'm sometimes a little chilled by the amazing discipline of those three-year-olds, thinking, my God, if this discipline can be extended over a whole nation, what it can mean. And then went from there by air into Harbin. Now, Harbin then was a city of some 2 million people, and we were in a 24 passenger Antonov, unpressurized, so that we didn't fly very high, which was fine, because you got a great chance to see the countryside. And as we're coming into Harbin, you can see over on the right side an airport with concrete runways, but we go by that. That was undoubtedly the military airport. We start to come in. There weren't even runways in this airport. It was just grass and pasture land. During my stay in China, they did build a modern airport in Harbin, but not at that time. And here we stayed at a hotel downtown, which had been built by the Russians some 40 years before. And it was not very well maintained, and very few people in a big hotel. Visited then an electric machinery plant where they made hydraulic power generators and water turbine generators and auxiliary equipment and steam turbine generators, and where the workforce did not seem as that much in excess as compared to the more southerly places. I would think, because in a relative sense, the population pressures there are not so great. And then that night, the vice chairman of Heilongjiang province invited us to the provincial guest house, where we were not staying. We were staying in the hotel I described, and gave us a banquet. And that was a very warm meeting. He subsequently became the governor of Heilongjiang province, visited the U.S. and
was Yang Yijun?
Yes. And we had a very wonderful evening. He's full of great anecdotes about the Civil War, about his role in the war against the Japanese, and it was really quite fascinating. Then we went from there by train to Daqing, the famous oil field and refinery area. Now here the specific thing we asked to see was the Pullman Kellogg fertilizer plant. They showed us another fertilizer plant put in by the Germans, I think, or the French. But it was inconvenient to see the American installation.
Do you know of an American who's on a tour of China was able to visit any of the Pullman plants? This seems to have been a problem everywhere, wasn't it?
I think so, yes.
Did you ever see any of the Pullman plants?
No, I didn't.
Did anyone in the embassy ever see one?
I don't think so.
Yeah, that's my
impression.
I don't
think so. And there they have we were housed in a guest complex where all foreigners were taken, which is quite new, quite modern, and very comfortable. And took us around to see the various wells and so on, including, of course, Ironman Wong's first well.
This was at a time when, were there many Americans already up there or not?
No. No, not at this point.
Any foreign presence discernible?
No. No. They took us to see their stores, their warehouse storage, and were very proud of the fact that since they had to deal with people from the countryside to do this, who had little education, that they went by fives, which of course made a lot of sense. And then they had a whole display of parts, and they told me to pick one out of a group of young people who were standing around. He was blindfolded. It was a he in the first instance, a she in the second. And then I was to pick any part and give it to this person who would feel that it was a collar around, and then he'd tell you the part number. This was repeated two or three times. In another building where I chose a young woman, I gave her a part number in this instance, and then she goes down the aisles and climbs up the shelving and reaches over, and sure enough, it was that was the part. So I said, well, this is very interesting, but why is this done? Well, so they can find parts in the dark if the power goes off. Well, I didn't say, well, couldn't electric flashlights do just as well? As we're walking down to the young woman who was taking us around, I saw an area for milling cutters, and there were only three milling cutters. So I stopped and I said, who decides when to order more milling cutters? The plan decides. What plan? The national plan. Well, suppose something goes wrong. Suppose you have an unexpected breakdown and you need more milling cutters than the plan provided for. Who keeps track to decide when you need more milling cutters? The plan is never wrong, she said, and sailed off down the aisle. But it was interesting, too, in Daqing. Have you been to Daqing?
No, I haven't. I've been both to Changchun and to Anshan, Shenyang, but not to Heilongjiang.
They told us that Zhou Enlai himself had prescribed that they were to prevent a city or a large town developing, and that they should have villages spotted around this whole complex, so that at the time the oil was played out, it would be a much more viable economic unit than if a massive town or city developed. And they took us to the pioneer village, first of such villages, where they made Gaoliangzhou, which is like Maotai, only without the Maotai, the water from that district. And this was 10 o'clock in the morning, and they showed me how it was made. Of course, I had to taste the brew. Maotai is 106, this must have been 150. It was very powerful. And also the vice chairman of the Revolutionary Committee of the whole complex. He gave a banquet for us while we were there. And there was the vice chairman from the production side and the vice chairman from the technical and cadre side. And I suddenly become conscious that they're rotating and offering toasts. So finally I laid down my glass and I said, all together. But when it was all together, they would be offering a toast every 3-4 minutes. And finally, the person who was traveling with us, the same person who was with us in Shenyang went to Anshan. The person who was with us in Harbin traveled with us to Daqing. This person suddenly says, The vice chairman of the Provincial Revolutionary Committee did not do that to our guests last night. So then the toast began to be to be spelled out. And they showed us a movie of the development of Daqing, which of course was full of the magical performances of the people. And I think too that warehouse business, they had thousands of Chinese coming at that time, at least. I don't know whether that continued to be true, every week to see this showplace of China. And the Chinese so loved magic performances that I think the warehouse business was for the visitors more than anything else. And then went back to Harbin and went for a boat trip on the Sangori River. Again, an example of how foreigners were shielded from Chinese generally, so much more then than a couple of years later. We want to go across to a certain island, and I see a ferry going back and forth every 5 minutes. And I said to our guide, why can't we travel on the ferry? We walked about 150 yards down, and there is a big boat. It had a crew of 5. The 3 of us got on, Rick Bach and the guide and myself. And this had been an overnight river passenger steamer. So we go cruising around on the river, passing boats, a third our size, jammed to the gunwales with Chinese. And then we stopped at this island to see a transistor factory which had grown from a small group into a fairly sizable operation, entirely, of course, by their own efforts. Then we went back by air to Changchun in the same Antonov. Now that Antonov was the air flight to Peking. Changchun to Shenyang to Peking, but when we boarded it again after having to get out for an hour, every stopping place you got out for an hour, an electrical storm grounded us. And I just had to be back in Peking the next day because Mike Mansfield was visiting us with accompanied by Jane Englehart and one of her daughters, who were coming as my guests. So we then took the express night train back. And it was a very, very revealing and useful trip, because I think it's pretty obvious the Northeast still is the industrial muscle of China. And I think I saw a study some short time ago that despite all the efforts to move industry inland, that although it has developed inland, the proportions are still relatively the same in the Northeast and Shanghai and the other previously developed places as against the industrial development in the rest of the country, which is a rather interesting phenomenon, if true.
A couple things about this trip to the Northeast. Did you sense some lingering favorable sentiment toward Soviets during their period of extensive involvement in the development of Manchuria in the 50s?
Well, in Harbin, I noted there were two war memorials to the Russians. And I asked our guide, why two? Isn't one enough? And this was done because of the high regard that the Chinese people have for Stalin, which was not an unusual answer. It was a pretty standard answer one got. Lots of evidence, of course, of the Russian influence, but nothing particular to to indicate a pro-Soviet bias, except in a sense references to the polar bear. And this was, I suppose, surprising, since they were on the close to the frontier, were less abusive than I was beginning to hear in other places.
Because my own view is that I've been up there a couple times, but on both occasions one senses not only the extent of Soviet influence, having been much greater in the Northeast than elsewhere in China. It's obvious, but one really can sense it. But I sensed less enthusiasm somehow for strong anti-Soviet policies, and I heard very warm references in Anshan to what Soviet advisors had done for Anshan. How I had one person about 10 Mao Tais later talk about how the Soviet advisors were pulled out, how sad everyone was at the time.
I heard none of that. The most relaxed evening was the one with the vice chairman of the Provincial Revolutionary Committee in Harbin.
Of course, he had gone up there later, hadn't he? Was he a long time Northeast?
Yeah, he was from Shandong.
Yeah, Yang Yichun.
Yeah. But he was the one that I was most conscious was not abusive of the Soviets.
Right. Second broad question has to do with, that was your first trip out of Peking. You had begun to be aware of the political climate in Peking, the post-Mao era, not fully post-Mao in a sense. There's still a lot of Mao, praise of Mao.
Very definitely.
How was the mood of the Northeast different from the mood of Peking?
People seemed somewhat more subdued. The the clothing in Peking had not much liberalized by September of 77, but even so, even then, contrasted with the provincial cities, which were more somber. More curiosity about foreigners than you were conscious of in Peking, although certain spots in Peking, as you know, there always can be a lot of curiosity. But that's about all, I think.
And were there any differences among the three provinces that you or Bach picked up in terms of references to Mao or references to Hua Guofeng and Deng Xiaoping?
In the briefings, there were, it was almost as though they learned a text in all the cases. As a matter of fact, in that regard, there was one amusing little incident in Daqing, where in the control room of one of the refineries, where all these control panels and everything is automatic, and the guide, not the guide who traveled with us, but the guide for this purpose, is explaining it all, and then he goes into his political peroration, which was all the same, that they had exceeded their quotas by dint of studying the thoughts of Mao Zedong and so on and so forth, which we got in almost exactly those same words every place. We're standing facing him, but behind us are six or seven of the technicians who work there. There was one in particular who was right, just across my right shoulder, who caught my attention first because he was rather tall for a Chinese. And this guy goes into this political peroration, he gets a great big grin on his face. And then as he finishes, I look back at him, at the technician. And he takes the grin off his face and walks to the end of the line. And he looks right at me and gives me another great big grin, as much as to say, "You don't believe all that crap, do you?" Because it was so impossible that personal effort could make any difference in this, which was purely controlled by time and other sequences. That was the only place where I saw that sort of thing. And these people who would make these speeches were obviously bored with them. I think maybe that was one difference, that the places you went in Peking, they'd give you the same line, but with a greater attempt to make it look as though they really believe this. And in the provinces, they particularly those not directly involved would just look bored as the devil, yawn, not have the same belief, obviously.
All right, we'll move on.
Well, it was just shortly after that that I then left China to go back to the United States. Stayed over in Tokyo. The Mansfield and the Engelharts were only in China 3 or 4 days, and I left a couple of days after that.
Did Mansfield see Deng? Who did he see?
No, Huang Jun. We had a luncheon for him at the...
Huang Jun had already returned.
Yes, we had a luncheon for him at the residence, to which we invited Huang Jun.
No, but Huang Jun was there just for home leave at that point, due to the Vance visit, because he didn't... Yeah, that's right, he had not yet returned.
I'm sure it was Huang Jun.
Yeah.
Yes, he'd come back for the Vance visit and was still there. And we had others there. We did not have Wong. I don't think we invited Wong Hyrung. We may have. We sent a report on the luncheon to the State Department. And then I went back for the visit. Purpose being to join the secretary in his meeting at the UN with Foreign Minister